7 session of the House Workforce and Economic Development Committee to order. And we're going to be having an informational meeting today, workforce and economic development in the agricultural industry. We'd like to call up first as a panel from the Northwest Agricultural Consortium, Kevin Boyle, director, and from the Northwest Food Processors Association, Dave Glick, who is the executive vice president. Kevin, it's been a long time.
Yes, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you doing?
Great, thanks.
It's so great to have you before our committee.
Thank you.
I didn't expect to see you in this capacity.
Until yesterday, neither did I.
Good morning to you too, Dave.
Good morning. Thank you.
Before you begin, and I'll turn it over to you to decide who's going to go first, before you begin your individual statements, if you would please introduce yourselves for the record. And again, the committee is most appreciative of your being here this morning, so thank you, and please proceed.
Good morning, Representative Witt, committee. My name is Kevin Boyle. I am the volunteer director for the Northwest Agricultural Consortium, which is a consortium of labor leaders, small and large agricultural businesses around the state, who came together 2 years ago around the issues and concerns around an available labor force within agriculture throughout the state. And we were given a grant by Governor Kulongowski at the time to do some research around the kinds of skills within the different industries in agriculture throughout the state. With our view being to research the competencies and skills needed within a broad scope of agriculture to really begin to take a look at the possibility, as in other industries, is there a skill ladder? Is there a level of competency that can be developed across the different crops within a rural area? Because part of our goal also was not only to create a system of development and training, but also begin to take a look at economic development within rural communities and attempting to keep a workforce, an available workforce for the growers available, as well as continuing to build the economic viability of the rural communities. So we hired the National Labor and Resource Center out of Oakland to do a study of the skills needed and the skills wanted by farm workers within the Willamette Valley. And we focused it, just on wine growers and nursery growers, as well as secondarily some of the dairies, because we really wanted to see what sort of transferable skills were available between those industries, with the idea of being able to take a look at not necessarily always being able to raise an hourly wage, which is something I'd like to talk to you about in terms of how we measure success within the agricultural labor industry, but also could we take a look at increase of yearly annual wages, because workers might move from commodity to commodity, crop to crop, and may not be able to garner the same hourly wage depending on skill, depending on need, from one crop to another. So we really began to take a look at the possibility of what skills are kind of the entry skills and how could they build a career ladder. And then seasonally, where are the high wage earning opportunities and in what skills? And then seasonally, having to take a look at where some of that labor would move back and forth. And we also then hired Chemeketa Community College and their agricultural department to go out and survey growers. And I think they surveyed about 110 growers within the nursery and wine industry from Newburgh down to Eugene, mostly focused in Yamhill, Polk, and Marion County. And we came out with a study and outcome of the possibility of a career ladder, it would almost be cyclical, where we could begin to take a look at working with employers as well as workforce developing organizations to hopefully keep people within a geographical area, because we found that 75%, even though some of us had an assumption of that this was a migratory workforce, it was not. Only about 23% was. So many people were staying in the community, so we were looking at opportunities to work with multiple growers so that they would have a stable and available workforce, and at the same time develop the skills so that the workers could move from commodity to commodity, crop to crop, and not have to be trained and retrained. since then, Chemeketa has done an excellent job of taking our research and beginning to develop courses for both farmers as well as workers, both in English as a second language and Spanish as a second language, to really, one of the things we found was communication was a key in terms of productivity. So beginning to take vocational language in both English and Spanish and teaching these courses so we can begin to provide opportunity for more communication, more opportunity. So at this point, I think I'll stop and you can ask me any more questions about our research and where we go from here. And I certainly have some challenges for you.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin. Before we get into questions, I think what I'm going to do is ask Dave to give us his presentation, and then we'll open it up to both of you as a panel. So, Dave, if you would, please.
Great. Good morning. My name is Dave Click. I am actually retired, the food processing industry has an interesting new opportunity for retirees, executive retirees, is they call them ambassadors. I told them anything but emeritus, but we are, several of us are, before we lose all of our vitality, we want to contribute, and I think this is really important as there are very critical skill needs and lots of people retiring, as you well know. Northwest Food Processors Association is the value-added extension of the agriculture industry. It's the food manufacturing throughout Oregon, and actually we represent three states, Washington and Idaho as well. Food processing or food manufacturing is the third largest manufacturing employer in the state, over 17,000 workers. And I thought I would just, in the few minutes we have here, take you through three elements. One is just to not talk too much about the challenges, because you're very familiar with the challenges that agriculture and value-added processing have had. Two is some of the approaches that we are using right now to that, which are in many cases leading the country. It's some very, very exciting things, and that's one of the reasons that I've continued to work in the food processing industry after 36 years. And then just finish up with maybe some additional opportunities, and there's far more information here on the testimony that I've given you, and so I'm certainly not going to read it, but just to kind of highlight some of the things that you can circle, and then if you want additional information. So competitive pressures has been well documented. We've talked about that over the last years, and there's a lot of food processing plants have been closed throughout the state, notices issued, and we have on our website a list of more than two dozen of those plants just in the last 7 years. So clearly there's some challenges, and I've listed six threats here to competitiveness, but certainly your committee is addressing a number of those. The shortage of qualified workers is one of the most troubling challenges in not only in the agriculture industry but all manufacturing, and we're in many cases competing for the same workers, as Kevin has outlined. But energy, water, distance of markets, regulatory, and limited innovative capacity, and that's one of the things that we're working on. That's very, very exciting. We've had a number of collaborative responses to enhance competitiveness, and offline I would like to talk to Kevin. This is a good bringing us together like this, because I'm not that familiar with the Northwest Ag coalition, and we have worked on virtually every one of the areas that he has mentioned, and we have a number of things that could be, I think, very helpful to them. But in 2003, the association embarked on a very innovative three-step cluster initiative to bring together the $21 billion food manufacturing in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and say that not only the food processors, but all of the suppliers and everyone, the government, labor, education, everybody working together and focused on value-added food manufacturing. More than 60 federal, state, private, public organizations have been involved in this four-year effort, and the stakeholders have invested well over $1 million in this. We have support from all three of the governors. Governor Kulongoski has been very, very supportive, and we're most appreciative of that. And then in 2005 and 2006, we embarked on a strategic assessment of the entire industry, and that has been completed. OECDD and CTED in Washington, Washington Labor and Industries in Idaho, or Idaho Labor and Industries, all have been very supportive of that, and it came out on the page two with five focus areas, which are very interesting, and that's where top management of the industry, government, everybody is focusing on these five areas to increase capacity of the innovation structure, and these are needs that we're addressing. Improve transportation infrastructure and services. Years ago, when I first started in the industry, transportation was really a hot issue. It was one of our core competencies. Over the years, that's kind of dropped, but now because of fuel prices and the challenges of the infrastructure is a major area. Developing a robust pipeline of qualified workers. Very, very key in every industry, and we're working on that extensively. Strategic alliances, and then also operational productivity at the plant level, right down to the mechanic at the plant floor. Several major efficiency and workforce initiatives. I just listed four. There's probably a dozen out here. But Industrial Efficiency Alliance for Food Processors, that is a five-year, $6 million project to change the way that food manufacturers manage energy. It's very, very exciting. It's a collaborative project with all of the utilities, Bonneville Power, and putting that into a project to change the way right at from the plant floor all the way up to the chief executive officer on how we manage energy. Lean manufacturing for food processors, I think you're probably familiar with some of that. We're working through the manufacturing extension partnerships, OMEP and Washington Manufacturing Services et al. That's a $3.2 million project over a 2 to 3 year period to teach high performance type of things to food manufacturers and to not leave behind the non-English speaking, especially Hispanic workers. Already we're seeing major benefits from both of those programs, and we have had meetings to share those results. Number three is we participated quite extensively in Governor Kulongoski's workforce manufacturing strategies, spent the better part of a year on that. And that is scheduled to launch next week, and you're going to be hearing much more about that. But a coordinated approach statewide for all industry, including food manufacturers, to address four key elements that will be coming out. And then four is the most exciting area in my 36 years of working with the agriculture and food processing industry is the establishment of a Northwest Food Processing Innovation and Productivity Center. This is a knowledge center of bringing together three states to coordinate all activities, and it's a hub and spoke type of arrangement where this nonprofit 501c3 organization is created. And I attached a two-page summary, which is the details of it if you're interested. But that is the idea there, is to work with many different organizations who are supporting the food processing industry, the Food Innovation Center, the Food Industry Leadership Council, our center, Community Seafood Initiative, OSARC, all these different acronyms, trying to pull them together and have a central source where you can go to the website and take a look and share information and bundle the clusters around a three-state, $21 billion industry and have them as a resource for everyone. I mentioned just a return on investment is diagrammed here in the back page here, but it is rather remarkable. The launch funding for this center, the Innovation and Productivity Center, is included in the innovation package, the Oregon Innovation Council's package, $38 million, and it's 3.6 for food processing, another $900,000 for community seafood initiative. So to launch that, and the return on investment in the first full year with 15 plant interventions at a modest 2% increase, productivity increase, is $2.2 million, and in year two with an additional 10, you're talking $5 million. So that it's a tremendous opportunity to not to have a center that you sit in the office and wait for people, but to go out to the plants and intervene right at the plant level and in productivity in motors and pumps and compressed air and steam and refrigeration and right on. Leveraging workforce fund is a tremendous opportunity, and of course, Washington and Idaho are looking at this huge investment that Oregon is making, and they're saying, we've got to get in there and do something, too. They have bills in the Washington legislature. I testified on last week the multimillion dollars for skill panels, for centers of excellence, things that different people will be on a competitive bid process. But we feel very strongly that this leveraging is good for everyone, and all the governors agree that working together as a region has definite benefits. I just put some additional opportunities for your consideration. We're never finished in this area, but there are several I think that would be certainly a collaborative approach. Over the years, I've worked with Employment Security here in Oregon, as well as the other three states, a collaborative approach to shortage in skilled workers, especially like mechanics and operators and things like that, so everybody's aware of what's going on, and we can go across borders and help each other. A model plant management and training competencies. We've got a whole program ready to go, and we're just awaiting some incentive funding because it's one of those kind of things that the processors themselves are not too excited about working on the infrastructure, but it's something that's needed. It's like a skill standard, which we've worked on quite extensively, and others. Workforce curriculum update and repurposing some of the old slide tape and some of these floppy disk type of things need to be updated to the CDs and DVDs and so that's a great opportunity. Technology pilot projects where we're looking at several opportunities, even through federal funding and leveraging USDA and National Science Foundation funding and things like that. And then also an electronic clearinghouse of information that is sorely needed. And we've taken some giant steps in Oregon with the Oregon Gateway Project, but we need to go much, much further than that. We've been in touch with them, and we can see some great opportunities of linking demand-side need, training needs of industry with the supply-side educational provider services very quickly. Right now, it's very it's very strenuous. And so we see some real opportunities for investment, and we stand ready to assist and share information that is definitely cutting edge in the United States in the food manufacturing industry. Thank you.
Dave, thank you so very much. Questions and comments for our panel, Representative Dolan.
Kevin, I want to go back to you. You were talking about skill ladders and an assessment by Shemekita. I'm very concerned. Was this in the field for workers at I'm from House District 59, the Dalles. Would this be for pears and cherries and following that process from picking to processing to shipping? Is that what you're looking at?
Most of the research that we did, Representative Dallum, was kind of a, if you take a look at a manufacturing model, you know, we created the iron for their industry. I mean, so we looked up to the farm gate. But we had Mr. Bailey from Orchard View Farms is on our consortium. We have Ron Henry from Bear Creek, which is with pears. We've got Tillamook Dairy. So we've got, and then we've got a lot of small wine growers and farmers from the Willamette Valley. So our research, to get right to your question, really looked at the idea of pruning, of tilling, of equipment, manufacturing, picking of small equipment on the farm, and packing. But once it got past the farm gate, because the inside the farm gate is where we're finding the greatest lack of skill and where we're having the greatest need for economic development. So most of all of our research, because we have Dave's work that's really taken a look at packing, transportation, and on to manufacturing. Certainly, as you start to look at a competency development within communities, I think there's a great partnership that's mm-hmm. available as we start to build those skills. But our research and the focus of Shemekita's education right now is inside the farm.
Follow up?
Please.
And, as you stay on the farm or inside the gate, what's the prognosis for workers, and did you have any projection for what it's going to look like in pear country in 3, 4, 5 years, 10 years?
Well, I think we probably took a look at both scenarios, you know, and I suppose what's going on in agriculture, as we all know, with the labor shortage and the issues that, you know, the U.S. government doesn't want us to talk about immigration, you know, the labor issues are huge. Because you can take a look at that and say, if we don't do something about A, labor supply, and then labor development, like all the other industries have done, then I think it looks pretty grim. But if you begin to take a look at the research, and sorry, Chairman, I do have a summary of all of our research, so I'll give you a copy of that. I forgot to give that to you before.
Thank you.
But part of that talks about that 79% of the people that we surveyed, workers, the workers, want to stay in agriculture. But they want to see that there's an opportunity for growth and development within that. And in talking with some of the farmers who are taking a look at, and, you know, I'm a sixth generation farmer from the Midwest, and we still own the farm, and I'm here in Oregon doing other work. And, you know, who's going to take over that farm? And a lot of the smaller farmers are starting to take a look at, you know, the workers that they have and say, you know, maybe they can continue to run this farm when I'm gone. And so I think as we start to look at creative ways to integrate the workforce into the industry of growing, I think there's an opportunity in a very bright future. But we've really got to rethink how we look at the issues of labor, skills, and development within the growing side of agriculture. Because if we don't get that right, we've got the manufacturing, it's too far away for them to do their work. So we have got to get inside the farm gate taken care of in some way. And we don't have an industry that is really collective. We've got the nursery growers that are collective under the nursery growers. We've got the pit fruit and tree fruit that are they're aligned under there. We've got the dairy farmers that are aligned under the Dairy Farmers of Oregon. We've got the wine growers. But we don't have yet a real movement to integrate those and take a look at how, if these skills are built, that if I'm working on a vineyard in the spring, doing the pruning and getting it ready, when that's done in May, is there an opportunity for me to go birth calves? And then, and after that, is there an opportunity for me to begin to take a look at, is there some temporary help needed on the nursery? And then by that time, we're back to, you know, the pruning of the grape plants, you know. So is there a possibility to start to create some real rural economic alignment around all of these industries, and then take a look and register some sort of competency and skill so that each worker can bring some sort of certificate that says, yes, I'm qualified to do Pinot pruning. Yes, I'm qualified to do Chardonnay pruning. Because those of us that just look at pruning think, well, it's the same. But there's a real competency to the different kinds of grapes, same with different kinds of trees. So we've really got to figure out a way in which we can integrate that growing side of agriculture in the state if we really want to take a look at how we maintain some sort of available and sustainable workforce.
Thank you.
Representative Gerard.
Yeah, I have a couple questions. And the first one's for Dave. And the question is, this committee's been looking at apprentice programs and trying to integrate those for especially in 11th and 12th grade and up above. It seems like you talked about problems with getting adequate mechanics and operators and that sort of thing. Don't you see that that would be real advantageous for you in the food processing business to come up with an apprentice program?
I'm familiar with the apprentice programs, both through labor organizations and through individual companies. We've never tackled that as an association, because there are existing ones out there. But I agree with you. I think that is an area that needs to be explored further, and to see how they plug into the talent pipeline for operators, for mechanics. I had the privilege of working the last 2 years on a major problem or major project that relates exactly to Kevin's area here, of taking forklift drivers and operators and moving them into the more high-skilled maintenance. And we've identified 6 training bridges that community colleges can provide curriculum, and it provides this career ladder that Representative Dahlem was looking at to bring the higher wage. But certainly we'll be looking at all the apprentice programs.
Okay. Follow up.
Well, this actually is a different question. But with NAFTA and GATT and various trade agreements that we have, especially internationally, is there any way to expand the food processing business in the markets overseas or in different countries?
We on NAFTA, we took a neutral position because it affects different members differently. Some of that are multinational corporations and things like that. But certainly companies are looking at the opportunities for an investment in other countries. We're certainly importing and very complex. Put your hand on a complex subject area, probably beyond my expertise, though.
Representative Holden.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on Representative Garrod's statement about the training, and it seems like I was kind of curious what kind of training and what kind of skills are needed, and you've reflected on mechanics, and seems like we do have training programs in our community colleges. You probably take advantage of already, with some mechanic programs. I don't know how many of them there are left in the state, but mm-hmm. I know there's probably a few. And millwrights is another one that pops in. It seems like millwrights would be really, pointed towards a lot of your food processing machinery and those sorts of things. So it seems like there are programs out there, but I'm kind of wondering what other kind of skill sets are you needing in food processing?
Well, all the technical areas are certainly in demand, but also management, just competencies in management. I'm working right now on a major skill panel project in the state of Washington to try and attract women, Hispanic, and other minorities into leadership positions. They're underrepresented in our industry, and as we've alluded earlier about the retirement, we're looking in the next 8 years, maybe 50% of our entire technical workforce, and I assume that that would project to the management too, that they're going to be retiring, the baby boomers. And we cannot replace that with traditional type of workers. So we need to be working in that. And so fully one third of our innovation and productivity center, we've got innovation on one side, productivity on the other, and then talent pipelining, which is the diagram you see here, this in the middle, that is going to deal exactly with those kind of things. And you see in the yellow bottom focus there, early focus is detailed competency standards, fine-tuned job descriptions, well-honed recruiting strategies, results-focused leadership development curriculum, motivating performance reviews, sound retention strategies. This is for the whole industry, so there'll be model programs and then shared throughout the manufacturing industry, and it sounds like we really should be sharing with the producers as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, just getting back to the whole workforce shortage idea, you know, sometimes I know that you're aware of to attract a workforce, you know, you have to be able to pay them enough to make a living, and if you don't, then you're going to have a much, much harder time attracting a workforce. And then we get into the whole issue of, you know, that's going to raise our costs, that's going to raise the prices of food, how do we compete? And, you know, so, I mean, you have some big issues there, but you know, clearly if people can't make a living in the field, so to speak, you know, it's really hard to attract people to work there. So, you know, it's really a tough issue for you to deal with, but, you know, I think it's one thing that should be considered. When I was growing up in the Willamette Valley, we would all go out and work in the fields and,
I was there,
you know, picking beans and things like that. And, you know, there, some folks could make a pretty good living back in those days working in the fields, and I don't know that it's still true today. So, you know, I don't know how do you raise the standard of living for people that are working in the industry and stay competitive.
Well, and of course, we're working the value added in the manufacturing plants, and the employees that tend to be left tend to be higher skilled. That we don't have the large cutting inspection rooms with lots and lots of people in there. When I came in the industry, that there, it's much more, you have to be computer savvy. You have to, even as an operator, you've got to be able to work that. So those are higher skills that we're trying to train to those competencies and to be able to move them in and have career ladders, as we've talked, which we've never had before, so that there is hope there that you can get beyond entry-level jobs and have a career path. And there's a wonderful program at the national level called Dream It, Do It. I've been involved in that for a couple of years, and Washington State was selected over Oregon, but we are seeing a synergy there. But it's going to kick off here within another couple of months, and that will be trying to make manufacturing a career of choice within the next 3 to 5 years, which would be really something. And we talked about it in the governor's workforce strategy meetings. But there are ways to show the young people and people in various technical colleges and that there are opportunities in manufacturing, and as it gets more sophisticated, then those jobs do increase in wages.
And we've also looked at that inside the field, because I think as I listen to you talk, Representative Hovey, that's really a challenge, and I know it's a challenge for growers. I mean, when we were talking to some of the growers in Washington and attempting to expand the consortium, you know, we're talking about 6%, 6 cents at the farm gate. Well, you start then to say, okay, so does the farmer get 3 and the worker get 3? I mean, there just is not a lot at the end of the day to share, from going broke to, you know, living in less than, you know, almost poverty conditions as a farm worker. So we've done a lot of looking at that. And, you know, in this, in the large industrial farms, you know, that's almost another issue. But when you start to really take a look at the smaller farmers and the smaller producers we have here, when you talk to them, they're saying, you know, we can make it if we really have the skills and the competencies of our farm workers, not just to pick, but understand that because now we're kind of moving into such a specialty market in Oregon around our fruit, around our grapes, around our nursery, and those side of things, there's a much bigger need to be much more careful in understanding how you treat that product, because if you're going to sell it to the Costco's, you're going to sell it to the Walmart's, you're going to sell it to whatever the five, you know, retailers left in the world are that really take most of our product, you know, they're expecting a certain quality. So if we can start to build some competency and our growers then can start to sell collectively to these larger groups, then all of a sudden it adds a couple cents to the farm gate. So we've got to start to take a look at the competencies and skill levels of picking and pruning and all of those sort of things, because those little differences make a huge difference in what's expected in the commodity market, in the fresh fruit, fresh vegetable commodity market, than there was 15 years ago, 20 years ago when we were working in the fields.
Representative
Bowen. I'm very interested in your concept, and I have a couple of questions. One that intrigued me, and I know that you work primarily in the Willamette Valley, but in reviewing the literature or in looking around, 77% stay here. I'm wondering if that's true in the tree fruit industry. That would astound me. It astounded me when you said 77%.
It astounded us because here's an assumption that we had when we went up to Washington, because Mr. Bailey, because he's got cherries on both sides of the river. There is very little even migration between Oregon and Washington. And that really astounded us. What we found was that where there is some migration, as we have in the Dalles and Hood River area, where we've got people moving across the river in terms of some of the tree fruit, and the other places out in near Boardman and Hermiston where the large dairy, and then we've got the wine grapes on the other side of the river. But very little. As we studied with both Washington and Oregon, very little transition between Oregon and Washington.
I'm going to have to. I have to change. I have to somersault my thinking here. But then, I want to ask you this. I know from being in the orchards, if you're and I'll use the term journeyman picker, you can make a living. The problem is not making a living while you're picking cherries. The problem is the next day. So that you average, and so mixing skill sets and finding things for people to do, I think, Representative Hovey, we can solve the problem. And if we can do that, we're very concerned in the cherry orchards in getting enough people to get the fruit off the tree. And I guess we should be more concerned about what they do the next day.
Exactly. I suppose this is one of the challenges for you. And I'm not sure if even at a state level we can deal with this. It may come out of, you know, the federal level. But one of the criteria that we really had, and thank Governor Kulongowski for being willing to take a risk and bend a little bit on this. But one of the things was that, you know, if you're going to have workforce development money, you've got to prove that their hourly wage goes up. And we could do that while a journeyman picker was picking in the cherry orchard. But when then we were taking a look at, doing some wine pruning across the river or in some of the up-and-coming wineries around Hood River in the Dalles, their hourly wage might go down. So in some cases, we were actually breaking the rules of workforce development funds. So what we challenge you with is let's take a look at the next day as a criteria. Can we keep them working on the next day? And will their yearly salaries go up? And will you begin to see economic development within rural communities because people are working all year and not just making great money during the cherry pruning and picking season, but then moving on and continue to stay in the community and working in whatever other industry? And that's a challenge, and I'm going to speak tomorrow at the Farm Bill hearing on the same issue. we've got to think about agriculture very differently than we might in manufacturing and other places if we really want to keep it growing and keep that stable and available workforce.
Dave.
A project in 2000 to 2003 in the state of Washington, we partnered with the Eastern Washington or the Washington Growers League over there, Mike Ampler, and we're under the premise that maybe some of the food processing mechanics or the operators might want to move into the line to come up towards an orchard manager, or vice versa. Maybe some of the mechanics, the ag mechanics, work on tractors might want to get into, because when they reach a ceiling, they can't get any higher in agriculture. But if they moved over into the processing, into into food processing, maintenance management, then they can increase. So we developed some career cross-industry, cross-agriculture food processor skill standards that we'll certainly share, but that was the first time that we had seen that anywhere in the country, because there wasn't a lot of migration back and forth between agriculture and processing, but we saw that there could be.
I just want to speak to that a bit, because I suppose as you listen to us, you know, we're really talking about the same, walking on the same path. One of the things that we heard from farmers, however, though, is as you know, so much of the training and workforce development money is training people to get off the farm. And very little of it is really developing people to stay on the farm. So when we train people to help the manufacturers be successful, we're really hurting the farmer because their trained workforce has just left. And that's this idea of being able to share between the manufacturing and the agriculture farm is a great idea. But I think sometimes we exacerbate our problem as we develop skills and people leave the farm because there's other opportunities. So I think that's something I don't know the answer to that, but it's certainly something that I know the farmers were concerned about.
And the one area that we saw is that some of the people in the urban areas are looking for that kind of lifestyle and would love the opportunity to get back on the farm. So if there are good jobs out there, we'd like to see that cross-migration.
Dave, one of the things that we've had virtually every industry that's appeared before our committee has described the veritable train wreck that we face 10 to 15 years out in terms of labor supply, both sheer numbers as well as adequate skills. And you've talked about the development in your industry of a pipeline and putting people into that pipeline. And hopefully I'm not putting you too much on the spot here, but can I bore down a little bit and, sure. and just pick your brain? What are some of the things that you're doing to get those people into that pipeline?
Well, of course, the image of an industry goes a long way. People look at the high-tech industry and say, wow, you know, that's really good, and they think of food manufacturing as grunt work or something like that. So we are eager to change that image, and this program, Dream It, Do It, is a very big step in the right direction. There's already $1 million designated to be working in the Seattle area to promote manufacturing careers. So image is certainly one of them. Just having a program of career ladders. We've talked about that. I've worked on career ladders for a number of years. We've never really had skill standards. We now have skill standards in some of the major areas of production workers, which helps in developing job descriptions, skill sets, competencies. We haven't really developed innovation and productivity. We need to encourage our employees to be much more innovative, and we have a plan for that, which is really, I think, getting at the problem. But having somebody full-time, I have worked, as I mentioned, for 3 decades in the food processing industry, and I'm the only person in the whole Northwest, maybe even in the whole country, that's working full-time on behalf of the food industry in the workforce area. And that's a real indictment. We need to put more people full-time working on behalf of lots of companies and put our best and brightest minds in there. And I'm willing to help train and mentor some of these younger people coming up.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of points. In this day of globalization, it's clear that many young people see that manufacturing of any type is a tenuous situation, that many of those manufacturing jobs are leaving. Now, I understand that food processing manufacturing is a bit different. You have to be close to the product there where it's grown, and you can't be shipping it all over the world to process it. So with that in mind, two things. It seems to me I like the idea that you're promoting, but I think you need to promote as well the fact that these jobs have to stay here. They can't go away. They can't go overseas. And the other thing is you need to promote his side as well, because without him you don't have anything to pack.
Absolutely. So
I think that, you know, that promotion of manufacturing as a place to go, food manufacturing, you need to also help him get that promoted as well. That was just a comment and
well taken. Thank you.
Kevin, I heard you describe a number of jobs that would potentially make it possible for an individual to have year-round employment. It's a concept not unlike one that Mr. Kluding was in the back of the room here earlier from the forest products industry and suggested the same kind of thing for folks who have perhaps been displaced in mills and their readily transferable skills in the woods, and the concept of bundling jobs so that we provide year-round employment. What's the model? What's the forum to make this happen? Are we talking about literally an agricultural school here?
Well, there is no forum. I mean, we're creating it as we go. And it's part of why I challenge all of us that we've got to create some sort of cross-pollination across products, because I don't think it'll work unless we have that. There's a couple things that I think we've got to figure out. The model, in my mind, would be that we would have, and we've done the research, what are those basic entry skills and competencies needed across a number of commodities and agricultural industries within a geographic area. So we'd have to do an assessment. We've begun that thanks to the nursery growers and the wine growers in some of the Willamette Valley. Then we'd have to take a look at, you know, what are the higher skills that are a part of each one of those products and identify what's transferable. What are the skills that are transferable across those across those different products? And then begin to take a look at the cyclical nature of when those particular skills are needed at a given time within each one of those products. And so as those are documented and as we can begin to share them, similar to what Dave was talking about, but between farmers, we begin to share them, all of a sudden there's year-round work. But also there's the ability to then to gain a new competency and skill. So then that year-round work, maybe it broadens the opportunity to go into Forest Service or go into the Christmas trees or go into something else that really raises their hourly wage as well as raises their opportunity for yearly wage. Couple things that are in the way. You know, only 20% of farm workers are recruited and hired through a formal process. So we've got 80% that are going by word of mouth, either from their home country in Mexico or their home tribes. We have probably less than that of our growers using the work source system in the state of Oregon as a way to get employees. First of all, the employees that they need, the employees they're going to have, aren't signing up at work source. Why? Well, 73 or 74% of the farm workers in the state of Oregon are not documented. Certainly got documents enough to get work, but they're not documented to be able to sign up for a work source system or even to sign up for a community college, for that matter. So that's an issue we've got to figure out. And we really know that we're going to be breaking some cultural barriers around that. I think the other piece that we've got to get together is that the farmers have got to get themselves aligned and understanding. And I think about my father. If you'd ask him what competency or skill he had, it was, well, hard work, right? But when I took a look at what he did and what he knew, that he wasn't sharing because he was an independent farmer. You know, there's a lot of competency and skill that takes place on a farm that we, just by looking, don't see. So we've got to work with growers to begin to document that so that we can take a look at geographic areas and say, all right, so how can we move people around yearly, but then how can we continue to raise their competency and skills by community college education? Maybe out on the farm. Maybe a group of farmers get together and say, Saturday, we want the community college to go out and do this competency skill for all of our workers. I mean, I think there's a lot of different models, Brad, but we haven't got there yet because we really need to get the farm community as aligned as Dave has with his manufacturing community to say, what is it that we need as a global community, not just what do I need to grow, you know, pears, and then once I get that worker, then they go off on their own and you know, hopefully I get them back next year.
Well, it's certainly good to know that somebody's working on it, Kevin. It really is. Dave, you had
just a real quick one. About 5 years ago, Dr. Eileen Casey-White at Chemeketa Community College worked with five industries in developing a cross-industry skill sets and skill standards, which is relative to some of the questions that were asked here. But it's when there is a downsizing in one area, say in forest products, we don't normally look at that, but we found out that there is a certain type of skill set there that would be very appropriate for a production supervisor. And that is part of the governor's program that's going to be rolled out, is this cross-industry skill standards. I'm excited about that one.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you touched on a subject matter that, of course, is a pretty touchy subject, I guess, when we're talking about immigration. And, you know, 70% of the workers in agriculture in Oregon, you're saying, are undocumented. And, you know, and this is a national problem of how we deal with undocumented workers, because we certainly don't want, you know, undocumented workers bringing our wage standards down and driving our economy down because people can't afford to buy homes, drive cars, things like that. So, we got some people in this state that, you know, want undocumented workers to go away, and clearly from your description, that would be devastating to many industries that need that source of workers. So how do we move from a culture that we're in right now, where it's just a very volatile subject, to actually being able to bring this skill set to the undocumented workers that you need, because as you said, they don't sign up for our government programs for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. So do we really need to advocate for this industry a pathway to document these workers so they can get into the system of our economy and raise their standard of living at the same time?
One of the things the Northwest Ag Consortium, when we got started, wanted to do is stay totally non-political. However, because of labor issues and because of this issue, we can't. And we have to do something. I don't know. I mean, it's such a complex issue. But I think what we have to do is tell ourselves the truth first. And the truth is that a bunch of the labor that we need fits the description of non-documented. I mean, and I know that I understand growers, you know, aren't going to stand up for that publicly, because what they're basically saying, especially with what the administration is suggesting, that if they, you know, knowingly have non-documented workers and they're liable by law, I mean, that's not the answer. You know, you certainly have workers self-identify as non-documented, and you give them maybe a temporary visa. I think that'll work for a while, but I don't think if you really take a look at the systemic changes we're trying to make in skills and development of a sustainable workforce in this state, as long as it is an immigrant workforce, I'm not sure that's going to work. I mean, I certainly have my personal opinions that we've got to take a look at this industry and be real about who's working it, and just go from there. I wished I knew the answer, because it is a complex one, and I guess that's why you all got elected and I didn't. But I mean, I don't mean that to be facetious. It's tough. It's tough, because to really have a truthful conversation about that issue means that the grower, myself, the worker, we indict ourselves to possible litigation because of the whole attitude about this issue across the country. So until we can have an open and honest conversation about the reality of this issue, Representative Holvey, I'm not sure what we do. But the truth is that we have an immigrant workforce that is the backbone of agriculture in the state of Oregon. That's the truth. Now, whether they are documented or not documented, that 70% of the people that we surveyed, and they were very open with us, said that, you know, they are not documented workers, and they come here to have a better place to live, and they're not interested in migrating. They don't migrate from California. They don't migrate from Washington. They live here. They are part of every one of our communities. And so I think that's where we have to begin, is tell ourselves the truth about this issue. The other thing that we're doing is really trying to work with, here's another political issue, but the UFW and a number of companies around really trying to streamline H-2A, to really starting to do some of these training programs in Mexico and Thailand and Vietnam, and trying to streamline the whole H-2A program. It is a very complex program for a small farmer. I mean, why would you want to put in 40 or 50 hours just filling out paperwork for an H-2A legal worker program? But we're really trying to work with some folks that really know H-2A, are willing to be employers of choice. So the UFW is not going out organizing farms. They're unionizing the work, so that these workers that are moving from place to place are under contract to the UFW, but they don't have to go out and organize all these small farms. That's working really well in some places. That's not working so well in others. But I mean, it's a start to try to really figure out how do you do this legally. And the federal government doesn't make that easy to do it legally.
Representative Dolan.
I think Kevin must have been anticipating my questions, because he answered every one of them but one. And that's H-2A. If you're picking cherries and you need additional workers and you start into the paperwork, next year's crop will be on the tree by the time you get the paperwork done. Maybe. You better plan 2 years out. So I think if this committee could do anything, and part of that is federal paperwork problems, but part of that is our Oregon paperwork problems. And if we could straighten that out and make access, it seems terrible to me that we make some of the finest citizens in my community criminals, and we make the people that are working and trying to make a living and trying to hook two ends of the string together criminals. It is. I think you answered every one of my questions, and I'll let it go at that.
Thank you.
I just want to recognize everyone's honesty here and the hard question, Representative Holvey.
Thank you.
It's important. It's important. And I think that at the point that we all are candid with each other, we can begin solving the problem. Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Thank you very much, anyway. It's amazing that the farm workers, about 96% to 97% are Latinos. And then out of that, the 70% are illegal, or the undocumented instead of illegal. It seems to me most of them are seasonal workers, if not employed all year round. If they are not working, how do they cope with their life? Where are their income sources and what they do, especially in the winter or any other seasons? Can you give me some...
Well, there is, if you look at agriculture, there is year-round work in agriculture. I mean, the dairy and the nursery industry certainly are very stable year-round industries. And nursery and dairy have seasonal work from time to time. So people, as they move out of their crop of choice or crop of knowledge, they tend to find, they're able to find some work, but there's no system that allows us to really organize that like other industries. So it's either that or it's day work, you know, standing on the street corner trying, waiting for someone to pick them up to do whatever kind of work. We just do not have a very good system that supports year-round agriculture. But yes, we talk about agriculture being seasonal, but it's in different seasons. I mean, we've got, you know, there's probably just a span from like maybe late November through January that we really don't have some sort of growing or harvesting going on in the state of Oregon. I think that, you know, possibility, if we really do get a system of, you know, of agriculture, that Dave's work, I mean, it's a real marrying of opportunity possibly, where if we're building some of the same sort of skills and competencies of forklift drivers, those sort of things, that maybe during that downtime of seasonal work, those competencies are used there. But we don't have even a way to document those competencies for a worker to go off Orchard View Cherry Farm and take a document to Dave's organization and say, I'm certified in forklift driving. Even if we did have that, unless you were legal, you probably wouldn't be able to get it. So there's work, Representative Lim. It's just we don't have a very good way of managing it because almost 70 or 80% of it is done informally through word of mouth or farm labor contractors that may just have a knowledge and a relationship in one industry.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, with that, I think we could probably go on all day long. This has just been a great discussion. I want to thank you so much. Dave, you told us about a very exciting and innovative industry, and one that's on the cutting edge here in Oregon, and showing us a pathway to high performance. And I commend you for your full-time work in that regard. Now, and I hope you're not too retired.
No. I dropped down from 70 hours a week to 40 hours a week in my retirement.
And Kevin, I've known you for a number of years, and I know that you've dedicated much of your career to economic and workforce development. And you've done a lot of pioneering work in that area. And both of you, our economy is in your debt. So thank you very much for your good work. And thank you so much for your excellent testimony here today.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call up from the Department of Agriculture, Brent Searle, please. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Members of the committee, for the record, Brent Searle, I'm Special Assistant to the Director of the Department of Ag, and appreciate the opportunity to visit with you for a minute. I think my charge is to step back a little bit and kind of look at the broader picture about the industry and give you a little broader perspective. You've heard a lot of detail, and will after me as well. You heard about the diversity of the industry, and this is both a challenge and a blessing in Oregon. We produce over 220 crops or commodities commercially in the state, and you heard some about the challenges that presents. It's a challenge to get growers aligned when their growing methods, their growing focus, and everything is focused on different crops and such. We do have some very unique things here, you know well about the berries, the Christmas trees, Dungeness crab, and so forth that are very unique to Oregon. The chart you see there on the first page gives a little bit of description. If you saw a chart from the Midwest, like this, a pie chart, you'd see corn, soybeans, hogs, and wheat, and that's about it. So in those areas, the skill sets are much easier to move across laterally than they are in Oregon. Just broadly, it's estimated we have about 150,000 jobs in the state that are tied to agriculture. I'll talk a little bit more about that. Farmers, as they grow these crops, livestock, etc., they purchase about $3.2 billion every year of inputs to go into producing that. So it's a huge stimulus in our economy and has many connections. About 2.1 billion is in that food processing value-added sector. I think our numbers are a little higher because we're looking at all of our food processing licenses, and a lot of those are very small. They're under 10 employees and such, but around 20,000 employees or workers in that industry. Approximately 2.5 billion in total salary across all of these sectors related to ag. Key traded sector, about 80% of what we grow in Oregon is exported, either as raw or processed commodity. And first in volume that leaves the state of export, and third in terms of value overall. And so summing all that up, it's about 10% of the state's economy is directly tied to the ag industry. I can briefly touch kind of on the structure because I think it gives you an idea of why some of these challenges exist here in Oregon in terms of our industry structure. We have about 40,000 farms, and a farm is defined by USDA as any entity that has $1,000 or more of agriculture sales or potential sales in any given year. So that's a pretty low threshold. And so about 40,000 meet that criteria. Various forms of ownership, about 88% are sole proprietor individual farmers. So again, it's a lot to organize when you have that many individuals out there. 5 to 6% are family partnerships, an equal number are family corporations. We have less than 1% of our farms in Oregon are what we would call non-family corporate farms. So the chart there on the second page, you'll see kind of outlines what's happened over time with this farming structure in Oregon. The first category there are small farms. We classify these as non-commercial. I mean, some of them are in it for business operation, but their size and scale is under $10,000. In 1992, that was about 62% of our farms, and that's gone up to almost 70%. So these small farms, you heard interest kind of getting back to farms, but a lot of hobby, retirees, lifestyle, those kinds of things are growing in Oregon. Ironically, the percent of their output is, in terms of total production is declining. It's less than 2% now. So keep that in mind. 70% of our farms produce less than 2% of the total farm output. And they employ very few people because of the size and scale. The medium-sized farms between $10,000 and $250,000 in annual sales are also shrinking. These are what we kind of think is traditional family farms, but they're getting pressed by costs, by market access, and all those types of things. Fewer farms, lower output, fewer acres controlled there. Our full-time commercial farms, and these are largely, again, family farms, are shrinking in terms of the percentage of that pie. The number's about static over the last decade. But the percent that they are producing is nearly 80% now. This represent, again, less than 6% of our farms produce 80% of the output, and they employ about 75% of all the employees on the farms. So we're talking about 2,200 farms in the state employ about 75% of the workforce there. And again, the acreage under control there is growing. So I point this out because that middle group is getting squeezed. The consolidation is taking place. Those that are able to stay in the commercial scale are assuming some of that cropland. They're getting bigger to stay in and meet the volumes that are required with the buyers these days, or they're getting smaller. And so you see that bifurcation going on. Skip over to the third page here and just talk broadly on some employment things. The on-farm employment, roughly 30,000 is roughly full-time year-round on-farm, to just give you some perspective on that. The peak in harvest season is about 90,000, so the average annual is about 58,000 employees. These are Oregon Department employee numbers. So again, you have some that are full-time there pretty much, others that join the workforce when those peak harvests come. And to the question about what happens in those off seasons, the data show now we have actually more of the Hispanic workforce outside of agriculture than inside agriculture. Traditionally, that's kind of been the entry point. And again, a lot of those have gone on to other things, construction, landscaping, the travel tourism industry. And so the population is higher there, actually, than it is in agriculture. And that's kind of where a lot of this back and forth goes in the off-season as well. A little bit of information on the wages there. I think it's important to note that the compensation that farmers pay to their workers is the single largest expense they have in the state. It's a significant cost for them, and Oregon ranks fifth of all states in total wage compensation or payments to their employees. We ranked 26th in total farm output. Okay, I'll let that sink in a minute. 26th is what we rank of all states and what we produce, but we're number 5 in total labor compensation. So our wages tend to be higher than average across the state, and we tend to be more labor intensive because of our specialty crops that we do here in Oregon. And you will see there kind of the estimate of the 150,000 jobs associated with the industry. And briefly, I'll just kind of talk about the future. I think in terms of the on-farm, there's a lot of transitions going on. This is similar to the known transition in the timber industry. I think you're seeing some retooling going on. We're seeing the labor availability issue and cost issue. So there's mechanization is going to be a factor here in some of this and how that balances out. For the first time in the last couple of years, we've seen mechanical harvesting of wine grapes coming on, pretty heavy in California and in Oregon to start. There will be more of that. These things are going to be competing needs in terms of labor force training, and again, the types of training that's going to be needed. It will be more equipment operation, mechanics, pretty sophisticated kind of things that are starting to happen. There's on the farms now GIS laser or GIS guided tractors, equipment. The irrigation is very sophisticated now with computer operations. A lot of things where I think the employees, again, it was pointed out, are going to have to be trained to a higher level of workforce there. The renewable energy opportunities, I think, are going to create some other different opportunities that we don't see right now on farms and in rural sectors, and there's some legislation coming through your legislative session that I think will help with promoting some of that. I've attached a couple appendices here. Appendix 1 is just to give you a perspective of all the types of industry jobs that are associated with agriculture. I'm certainly not going to read through this. But there is such a breadth. When we talk about agriculture, we view it as very broad. It encompasses everything from scientists, engineers, ag marketing, education, communication, and even social services. There are jobs related to the ag industry and so forth. So the jobs aren't just limited to on-farm and food processing. This is a very broad industry. We put together or assisted in putting together a report to the higher ed Oregon University system on agriculture, forestry, fisheries, food, and wine, and the job opportunities by linking the high-tech industry, the natural resource industry, and the higher education in Oregon, and that report is attached here for your information. So at the college level, in terms of four-year degrees, the projection over the next 5 years is 52,000 jobs a year that are going to be in demand for this broad range of jobs, and qualified candidates or graduates are not feeling that. So demand is there all across the board in a lot of these areas, and I will conclude there, Mr. Chair, and try to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Searle. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify one thing that you said when you were talking about the on-farm employment wages, where you mentioned the compensation paid farm workers being the fifth highest in the United States. And, you know, I'm reading that and listening to you, and that's the total compensation paid to farm workers. And I guess my question is, how many farm workers is that? How does Oregon rank in the level of wages per farm worker across the nation?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Ms. Hovey, good questions. Oregon ranks about 12th in the number of employees, so we're not in the top 10, but we do have more than most states, again, because of the labor intensity. The wage rate, and I think you'll hear more detail in some of the specific sectors here, but on average is about $10 an hour in Oregon, which is about $1.50 to $2 higher than that average nation for farm work. So it is higher, again, for a variety of reasons. Part of that is, you know, our index minimum wage kind of pushes the whole level of wages up across the board there. Some of it is due to the specialty of what that is demanded or expected of workers here in Oregon, and very specialized types of work that you heard about in terms of pruning and mechanics and those types of things. Piece weight ranges can be much higher than that. As was mentioned, I mean, during harvest season, some of these employees can be earning $20 to $25 an hour farm work. The annual average farm worker salary is about $20,000 to $22,000 a year, and that's, you know, time on the farm. So it's obviously lower than some other industries. It's higher than others. I mean, I can give you information on both ends of that, but it's, again, you have to keep in mind, it's most of that, or some of it, is not year-round as well, so they're doing other things to add to that as well.
Representative Bowen.
I want you to forgive me, Chair Witt, but I want to... I can't help but go here. I want a pie chart. How many of us eat? Because we're on I represent farm country. And I finally found somebody to sit out there that I can ask this question to, because in our country we need somebody that's certifiably smart. Should I raise wheat or canola next year? And I have a purpose in where I'm going. Our farm community is really in flux.
Mm-hmm.
And moving the farm from the next generation is probably the most serious consideration that any owner has to make. And the young people that are looking at farming are, we hear the same refrain every time. We don't have the same people going into manufacturing. We don't have the same people going into anything. And on the farm, we have exactly the same problem. Junior is looking, and junior is not junior, by the way. Junior is 40 or 50 years old. And he's saying, do I really want to do this? So if I could just tell him what the price of wheat was going to be for the next 5 or 6 years, I think I could convince him to stay.
Mm-hmm.
It's hugely complicated. When we talk about wages on the farm, I know cherry pickers that far exceed that. But they know how to pick cherries and leave that little stem that signifies next year's crop, and they pick them fast, and they get them in the bucket, and they get them onto the bin, and away they go. But if we look at it in total, he had learned sometime.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was learning, he probably wasn't worth minimum wage. But you have to have him there, and you have to suffer that expense. So I guess I'll leave it at this. The pie chart for how many of us eat is 100% of us. I still don't have the price of wheat. You're going to tackle that for me? I don't want soft white wheat, please.
Mr. Chair, do I have to answer that?
No, we don't force answers from anyone.
I would just comment, very important point. The average age of farmers in Oregon, and this is pretty consistent nationwide, is 54 years old. It's an important point. About half of the land ownership in Oregon is in the hands of farmers who are over 60 years old. There's going to be a huge transition in the next 10 years in our agriculture industry, and it's a significant question about how we retain the workforce, but how we retain our farmers and encourage our young people to come back to the industry.
Thank you. Thank you for making a decent question out of all that.
It's a future in the futures market. Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
the touch issue, such as 70% undocumented. What's the state policies on that? We just look the other way, or how do we handle that situation? I don't know whether you can answer that question or not. You know, currently anti-immigration nationwide, trying to secure the borders, and at the same time we need farm workers in our state. And what's the honest answer on this one, if you could give us one? I'm sorry, asking that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, I guess I would have to throw that back to you in terms of state policy on this. I mean, those are decisions of the legislature and the governor and our, you know, our Congress. As was stated earlier, I think the honest answer is a good portion of our workforce in this industry is in that position. And again, the future of the employment there is going to be whether we can work out this issue of availability of workers and training them. The flip side of that is more mechanization and loss of some of our specialty crops, because some of these take hand labor to maintain their quality and move them into the market that way. Sorry.
Representative Holby.
Well, to follow up on Representative Lim's question, I guess I just want some clarification. You know, we set policies. We obviously don't set immigration policy in this country. It's set by the federal government, and they're the ones that control our borders and decide whether or not people come into this country legally or illegally. So I guess my question to follow up on Representative Lim's question is, you know, if 70% of that workforce out there is undocumented, I mean, how do we pay them? Do they have Social Security numbers, and you know, are they paid with W-2s? Do they pay taxes? And you know, those sorts of questions. I mean, how do they fit into our tax structure, and how do they fit into our revenue picture? I guess if they're undocumented, they must get paid somehow. And how do we track that? We seem to have all the statistics about it. So evidently, it is being tracked, and they must be being paid legally. So they, you know, have some sort of documentation to make that happen, I would think.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, there's a whole lot of questions there, and I'm probably not qualified to answer all of them. The numbers I provided you are survey numbers by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They survey employers here just like other entities survey other employers and gather this data. The challenge for an agriculture employer is when they're presented documentation, as all employers are required to request for employment eligibility, they have to verify that they look legitimate. One of them can be a Social Security number, but there's other documents that can be presented. If they look valid, they have to accept them, or they risk being sued for discrimination. So it's kind of a catch-22. There's a check system for Social Security numbers. I think most employers try to go through that process if they have a Social Security number. At least 30,000 of those employees, the ones that are on the books, so to speak, year-round, are being tracked by the Oregon Department of Employment. So they have, and that's tracked through the unemployment filing system. So they're paying, you know, everything that has to be paid as a recorded full-time employee. There's exemption in state law for farm employers who have less than $20,000 of quarterly payroll or less than 10 employees in a quarter. I think that's correct. So some of them aren't captured in that employment reporting process, and why you have to come up with other estimates and other survey work. I think you could get other experts in here and give you much more detail on those topics than I'm probably qualified to give you. Apologies.
Thank you, Mr. Serlin. Any other questions or comments from our committee members? Thank you so very, very much for your for your very fine introduction to the agricultural community. We appreciate your statistics very much. Our last panel, we're going to invite up Terry Witt from Oregonians for Food and Shelter, Don Schoenberg from the Oregon Farm Bureau, and Jeff Stone from the Oregon Association of Nurseries. Gentlemen, if you could keep your remarks to roughly 7 minutes apiece, that would give us some time for some questions at the end. Welcome, and thank you all very, very much for appearing before our committee. Let you decide who goes first.
Why don't you go ahead, Terry? Fine, I can go ahead. My name is Terry Witt. I'm Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. Appreciate the opportunity to speak today. Much of what I will cover is I'm sure will be covered more in depth by Jeff and also Brett had covered a lot of the information that from a general perspective, and I just want to make a few comments, and I'd be glad to answer any questions specific to our particular area of concern or expertise, which is the fertilizer, pesticide, and biotechnology arenas. It was kind of interesting. I was talking with my son, who is an engineer, and he was asking me what I was going to do tomorrow, and I said, well, we're going to be talking about agriculture, and he's a real technocrat when it comes to it. And he said, you know, Dad, he said, there's a interesting analogy between business and agriculture in physics, and he said that's one of the first laws of physics, which is for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. And when I thought about that, I said, you know, that's really true in the legislature. We do things oftentimes without looking at all of the reactions that happen downstream, and one that we're dealing with right now that I think will be big in terms of agriculture and forestry employment is the impact of the decisions surrounding ballot measure 37. One of the things that I think we will be facing in the next 10 years is the decrease in availability of good agricultural lands and forest lands that are productive. Before I came to Oregon 20 years ago, I lived in Michigan, and Michigan was in a situation I think very similar to where we are here in Oregon, and that is that they put all of their emphasis in the automotive industry and basically neglected one of their big economic engines, which is agriculture. I think we face the same potential problem here in Oregon, and I think as Representative Dahlem so aptly commented, the one thing that we can say for certain is that everyone has to eat and everyone would like to have a house and a roof over their head, so we need wood products. Those are two consistent things that we can count on, and we cannot discount the natural resource industry and the importance of it, not only as an economic, stable economic engine in Oregon, but also the need of providing essential inputs to our citizens. I think there's a couple things that are happening in Oregon that will pay big dividends in terms of not only the economics of Oregon in the natural resource industry, but also new employment. And one, our innovative projects like the Oasis Project that are looking at capturing water that can be used then for expanding jobs and growing crops that may be biofuel crops, feeding another fledgling industry that I think has great promise in the state of Oregon. We tend to sometimes be nearsighted in the way we deal with things, and we cut research money to Oregon State University and Oregon Health Sciences University, and there again, that's a very short-sighted decision that I think in the long term pays negative dividends. We have some new technologies in Oregon that we are poised to be a leader in things like nanotechnology, some of the biotechnology industries, I think, with our research people that we have here. But again, it's going to take some innovation and some forward thinking to not, in essence, cut off our nose to spite our face when we get into where we can ascend our dollars. So I think those are very, very important. And I think, lastly, when we're dealing with, I think Representative Dahlem hit the nail right on the head, do I grow canola, do I grow wheat? We need some stability in some of those areas, and it's not always just, I think, appropriate to give tax breaks or incentives, artificial incentives. I think we have to build a strong infrastructure so that if we build a biofuels industry in Oregon, that we don't wind up having a biofuels industry that's fueled entirely by Midwest corn or by out-of-country palm oil. That we make sure that that we have a structure put together that deals with what we can grow in Oregon or in the Pacific Northwest, so that it's a win-win situation. So be glad to answer any questions later on, but again, most of my comments from this perspective need to be, I think, from a more general perspective. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Terry.
And I do know Don. But
looks like Don's up.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau, and I have good news for you. I don't know, did they hand out this document yet? No, he's ready to do that right now. This is what I would call the agriculture workforce development blueprint that I'm handing out to you. I went home last night and developed this for you. And what it is, it sets forth on the first page inside about agriculture and a very, very, very short version of what Mr. Searle presented to you this morning. Then on the next page, it provides a prescription for healthy family farms in Oregon, and it talks about Oregon Farm Bureau. Oregon Farm Bureau is going to be celebrating our 75th anniversary this year.
Congratulations.
As an organization, thank you. Our roots are in Umatilla County. That's where Oregon Farm Bureau first began. And Oregon Farm Bureau is a general farm organization. Now, we have one commodity association here, and there are others. You have the livestock associations. You have the wheat association. You have different berry associations and et cetera. Oregon is a general farm organization. We don't deal with issues of production, marketing, specifically. We leave that to the commodities to do themselves. We look at the larger picture. Terry mentioned the land use issues, the labor issues. They all have a relationship to each of those commodities, but they're kind of the big picture issues that the commodities don't really want to get involved in. They don't have the time to work on those issues, and that's the issues that we do. Our organization is a very policy oriented organization. Everything we do in our organization revolves around policy. It's very much like your legislative process. Our policy development process begins with a resolution. Farmer says, I've got a problem here. And he comes to the County Farm Bureau meeting and suggests, lays out what the problem is. Another one might say, after discussion, they'll say, here's the answer to that problem. So then they develop this resolution that sets forth the problem and the answer to that problem. And that resolution then comes into our office. We print it up and send it back out to all the county farm bureaus so they have an opportunity to look at that particular resolution. Then in October, we have all of our county presidents come together. They look at all those resolutions, and they make a recommendation to our House of Delegates. Now, our House of Delegates is a 90-member House of Delegates, much like yours here. It's a representative form of government as well. Not an equal, however. They don't all represent the same number of people in that a county, it's based on the number of members you have in your county. The more members you have, the more delegates you get at the House of Delegates. The House of Delegates then reviews all of those resolutions that are recommended to them, and whatever they adopt becomes the Bible. This is our policy book, and each one of you have one of these. We delivered those earlier this week, or maybe it was last week, I forget now. I'm sure you've all taken time to read clear through this, and so maybe I don't need to say anything else. On the next page, we have then divided agriculture issues into seven subject areas, and those include protect availability of production practices, protect Oregon's agricultural land base, protect agriculture water rights, enhance rural communities, improve Oregon's business climate, enhance market opportunities, and then provide environmental benefits. And then the following pages then take each of those subject areas and expand on each of those subjects briefly, and then we have some one-sentence statements about positions that we would have on specific issues within those subject areas. I would encourage you to read through that. That would give you a very very good indication of, you know, certainly where Oregon Farm Bureau is. But again, what I'm saying is this is the blueprint for workforce development in Oregon. These are the things we have to have if Oregon agriculture is going to succeed, both now and into the future. Maybe I'll just stop there just with that overview and not get into the issue specifically. Terry has mentioned some good ones, and you've had this discussion on labor this morning, a very key issue for Oregon agriculture. One that probably hasn't been touched on maybe is taxes. That's, of course, a key issue for us. And the estate tax issue is a big issue for us. You've all heard the statement, we're land rich and cash poor. And it's very hard to transfer your property from one generation to the next. I sit on the Century Farm and Ranch program board. I'm chair of that board, where we honor farmers across the state each year who have been on their farm, their family has been on their farm, continuous operation for 100 years or more. And we are having about 20... anywhere from 15 to 20 per year achieve that distinction. We have over 1,800 statewide, and we're now going to begin honoring those who have been on the same farm, same family, 150 years. We're going to be starting that in the next year. So thank you again for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you very, very much, Don. I appreciate that. We'll probably get into some questions, get you a little deeper than you went here. So, Jeff?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Jeff Stone. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. The Oregon Association of Nurseries is located in Wilsonville, Oregon. We have more than 1,500 wholesale growers, retailers, landscapers, and suppliers. Oregon's nursery and greenhouse industry is the state's largest agricultural sector. As an industry, we lead all other sectors in Oregon agriculture in sales, payroll, and full-time employees. When combined with our Christmas tree members, our association generates over $1 billion a year annually, with a B. That's Columbia Sportswear big in terms of an industry. We are the third largest nursery state in the country, following only California and Florida. And 75% of our nursery product is shipped east of the Mississippi. The economic impact on agriculture has had a steady growth over the past two decades and continues to be a major contributor to our economy. As you heard Brent indicate earlier, more than $4 billion with a total impact of over $12 billion annually. Our foundation industry is tough work, one fraught with risks, and agriculture is a way of life that produces one in every 12 jobs. A poll conducted in the Portland metropolitan region, by Metro actually, showed that 71% of that region saw agriculture as a viable and important part of the economy. That hasn't been really done before. Now about nursery employment. The nursery industry supports a total payroll of about $294 million. That's 2005 numbers, which does not include the salaries to the owners. We employ 10,400 full-time workers and another 11,500 seasonal workers. Even with that number of employees, agriculture continually finds itself with a shortage of labor. While crops are not as perishable as, say, strawberries, the lack of labor really limits our ability to handle plants and ship our plant material. The nursery industry pays the highest average farm wage on the continental U.S., us in Washington. Part of this is due to our high minimum wage, but that's not solely the only reason. Our workers, including our entry-level people, earn to an average of $10 to $11 an hour. We pay these wages to relatively unskilled workers because more and more nurseries need to have this workforce year-round. And while we employ seasonal workers, utilizing mainly in our peak season, the old adage of a migratory workforce really has gone away. You used to start in Texas and then go to California and up the West Coast as the seasons progressed. You're not seen as much because Oregon is blessed with a year-round growing season. Our largest nursery employs 58% of the workers and pays 74% of the wages. But every day, nurseries face increased transportation costs and threats from development. Wages, as Brent indicated, are our biggest expense, over a third of our expenses for sales. So if you look at our total sales amount, a third of that is taken up by our labor costs. Characteristics of the nursery industry. I thought I'd take just a second to, and you have this more detailed in my comments that have been submitted to you. We have several different type of operations within the nursery and greenhouse industry. We have bare root, we have fallen burlap, which are the big trees that get dug down and they're very heavy to ship. Container and greenhouse. We also have a retail section, which produce a stunning variety of different type of plants. With such diversity, the industry has experienced tremendous growth, $235 million increase since 1990. As I mentioned, we have over 1,500 members, and the characteristic of our industry is varied. A lot of people think of, you know, because it's a billion-dollar industry, that they're all big. Well, we only have 38 members that sell of over $5 million in their sales annually. Over a third of our membership are small, between $1 and $100,000 in sales. So if you look at it, there's a great diversity within the type of industry, even within all the different type of plant material that we have. We feel that we've talked about immigration today, and I can answer some of those questions, I think. With my experience, I'm a former staffer to the United States Senate, so I've dealt with immigration for a long time. But I appreciate your time and your interest in agriculture today. As you see, this foundation industry is one that is an industry. So when you place development or industrial purposes on agricultural land, you are replacing one industry with another. And so with that, I'll conclude my remarks and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Just for comparison purposes, and I know that there are different bases in which you can make the comparison, wages, total product, employees, and all, but generally speaking, where does agriculture fall in Oregon in terms of the top number of industries?
Number two.
Okay, thanks very much. It looks like Representative Girard has a question.
Yeah, this is for Terry, what's his name, or Jeff. When I called a lot of the farmers in my area, the number one issue that I was getting, I was really, really surprised, was water availability. That's an infrastructure product that we probably could have some impact on. Would any of you like to kind of discuss water availability and how it relates to the industry?
Mr. Chair and Representative Girard, water, you know, next to land, water, you have to have water if you're going to grow crops. And the water availability is being heavily impacted currently, and the current amount of water that's available is being heavily impacted by increasing urbanization. as you may or may not know, there's a whole water rights system that anybody who wants to draw water out for production purposes has to go through, and you have to have a water right, et cetera. But then all domestic wells are not a part of that water right system. You have the ability to sink a domestic well. You may have to get a permit, but you just go and get a permit without looking at what's in that aquifer, whether it's been decreasing or holding steady or whatever the case may be. And then you can irrigate, you can use up to, I believe it's 15,000 gallons a day on your up to a half acre, I think is what it, I think the two combinations, 15,000 and a half acre. Measure 37, been mentioned already, that gives us great pause, and we're looking for a pause in the Measure 37 issue, so that we have a chance to deal with that water issue as a part of that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrod, it is our belief that you have to have sustainable water supply for agriculture. And there's a number of ways you can do that. Part of that is also the responsibility of industry to do better on the conservation side, become more efficient. You have a lot of examples, especially within the nursery industry, Tom Fessler's farm right up in Woodburn, where they've reduced their water intake by over 60% because he went to a different type of irrigation system. So we are very water dependent. Without it, our industry, certainly, that billion-dollar industry would certainly dry up as fast as the water was gone.
Representative Dolan.
And my question is, I used to think it was Don, but I guess it is, what's his name? We've often said in ag country that we don't really want to compare checkbooks with you. What we want to compare is our appraisal. Explain to me what happens when the next generation, you talk about century farms and 150-year farms, what happens to this middle group of farms that we see that is shrinking when Dad wants to pass his farm on to the next generation financially? What happens to them, Don? How do they get that done?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlman, it's difficult to do. It takes a lot of attorney work to get that done. It's very expensive to be done that way, and that's the reason that we've supported over the time increasing the threshold exemption figure. Currently in Oregon, it's $1 million. It doesn't take hardly anything to get to $1 million anymore in a farm operation. You're talking tractors and combines that are running in the $200,000 each category. That's just a couple pieces of equipment, much less your land. And no, the land isn't as expensive as it is inside the urban growth boundary, but it can't be either. Land has to be at a value that farmers can trade back and forth, and they can pay for it off the commodities that they produce. But it's very difficult. Some would buy insurance to cover the estate costs, but that also is expensive. They need to be putting their money, I mean, farmers just traditionally, you put your money right back in to the operation. I farm as well. I've got a 90-acre farm, and so my wife insists I keep my day job. and we have this checking account, and she's always concerned about that checking account, that it seems to be going down faster than it's going up in my farming activity. But it's a difficult thing. And a lot of we're seeing a whole lot more young farmers actually in the Farm Bureau. It's rather encouraging, and our hope is that they don't get discouraged, as you heard today, that they don't get discouraged, and that the parents are able to transfer that farm on to the next generation.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I can perhaps put a pretty fine point on this. There's a lot of our growers who one of their most predominant concerns, despite transportation, the labor costs, all that, is how they're going to pass their farm on. And the real concern is that you would have to sell off part part of your farm in order to pay for it to be passed on. And that's like choosing between your children, you know. And so I think a more holistic look, like what Don was talking about, is looking at, and perhaps if Congress takes action on the estate tax, to not, we're not advocating repealing it, but to provide greater exemptions for agriculture, will, and have the state relink to that if it is a balanced approach, I think is, you try to solve 80 to 90% of the problems that you would see, because that's something that weighs on their mind when they're out there in their fields.
Jerry, there are other landowners besides farmers that face similar situation?
Mr. Chair, I would presume that the same thing would hold true for the forest products industry as well. As we see, you know, urban encroachment into these areas, it makes it much more difficult. Even though we have right to farm and right to forest laws, it becomes much more difficult just because of the unavoidable things that happen, noise, odors, those kind of things, and you start getting neighbor-to-neighbor conflicts, and the next thing you know, the farmer or the forester is just not able to continue their operations as they have in the past. So I think it's just a generic problem that we're facing in the entire natural resource industry, regardless of the commodity that's being grown or the method.
It probably doesn't take very many acres of forested land, not unlike farm equipment, to run up to the $1 million, does it?
No, that's correct, Mr. Chair. And I think the other thing that's a little different with the forest products industry is that your rotation, instead of annually, your rotation is 40 to 60 years. Mm-hmm. So if you have a chunk of property with trees that are 30 years old, you're not going to receive any revenue off of that for another 20 to 30 years.
So it comes time to inherit the property, and I'm the next generation, and I don't have the money to cash out of my pocket. What do? Take a loan?
Sell. You turn it into a subdivision.
Mr. Chair, Don Schellenberg, Farm Bureau. Yeah, that's one of the options. Yeah, the other option is you sell something. If it's forestry, they log off a certain portion of it ahead of time, prematurely before they would otherwise. In a farm case, you maybe, if you can, you sell off some of your property, or you borrow money. I have one gentleman who I know, who his dad passed away when he was fairly young, and they borrowed money to pay the estate tax at the time, and it's taken them over 20 years to recover from that.
I'm probably asking the obvious here, but very briefly, in terms of farming and timber policy and those sorts of things, I can't believe that selling off and going smaller, when Mr. Searle told us earlier that there seems to be a movement towards aggregating lands, that is probably a beneficial policy for agriculture?
And Mr. Chair, Don Schellenberg, again, no, it's not beneficial, and that's the worry that we all have, because your operation becomes less efficient or inefficient, and ultimately it gets less efficient as time goes on. You finally have to sell out altogether.
Mr. Chair, I think one of the other problems that we've seen is that historically, as these farms and production facilities would transfer from generation to generation, there would be a time where both generations would be operating side by side on the same farm. That means that the farm now has to be capable of generating two family incomes. And as you start decreasing that acreage, that becomes an impossibility. So until dad's ready to fully retire, there's really no room for another generation to come and work the same land and make a family wage living off of it. The other thing is that the land has typically is the retirement for the parents. So, you know, even if it's a large enough farm to produce a significant farm gate income, mom and dad still have to be pulling retirement off of that, even when they're no longer actively farming.
I think that Mr. Searle's figures showed us that
smaller farms tend to employ fewer people. Thank you very much. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know the time is drawing short probably for my questions, and I hope I, as the months tick away here, that I do get an opportunity to talk with each of you individually on a number of agricultural issues. Because, you know, you've touched on a lot of subjects that I'm interested in, and just water is so important as to your industry, as it is to everybody. We have to drink water, too, you know, and that's something that's very important. The quality of our water in this state is beginning to trouble many. So, as well as air. But, you know, and Mr. Stone, you touched just briefly that you did work in Washington, D.C., and, you know, this whole workforce issue is something that our committee's been hearing about, and I know it's of great concern to you. And, you know, and I recognize that your industry, you know, as from previous testimony, you know, is very reliant on the immigrant population and, you know, the policies around, you know, whether we hire undocumented workers. I don't know that you have official policies on that, but certainly a great many of your workers are undocumented. And so I'm curious whether your associations and industries are, I guess, have positions or policies that you're trying to address this immigration issue and trying to actually provide pathways for or advocating for those pathways for your workers to become documented so that we can get them into the system of training and get them into the system of health care in the United States. I'm just wondering if you have any comments on the Farm Bureau's or the nurseryman's position on trying to advocate for this population.
Mr. Chair, I refer to Holby. I'll do this in the quickest lightning round way that I can. But I'd be happy to talk with any of you about this issue because it is one of grave concern. We are working very hard. I do federal affairs as well as state. And so we're working very hard at the national level for a comprehensive immigration reform. Now, what does that mean? Well, first of all, you do have to have a secure border, so I think we all can agree upon that. However, what do you do with the 12 million, or that's just the Hispanic workforce. There's well over 20 million of folks. So even if you expelled all the people who may be undocumented, you don't have, with current unemployment, enough workers to fill those jobs. It's not a matter of just pay them more. I mean, I've heard that argument from a number of sides that maybe you would attract, you know, U.S. citizens. I'll use that broadly. It doesn't work that way. Nursery stock in particular, no one drives 3,000 miles for a cheeseburger. But we ship 3,000 miles away, and so our price sensitivity of selling a plant or a tree is pretty, it's very competitive. We're competing against North Carolina, Tennessee, all until the federal government just passed the minimum wage increase. They had $2 less an hour than we did. Now, we feel it's incumbent upon us to pay our workers well, treat them well, because we do have a year-round growing season. But part of the problem with our national immigration policy is that it's one way. You can enter the country, you have not a great ability to go back home, if that's where they choose. Now, not all people who are here to work in agriculture want to stay in the United States. That's a false assumption. But I would say that folks who work in agriculture work hard. I took Senator Smith's staff out to a Christmas tree operation. It was great. It was helicopters and chainsaws. It was just awesome. But to have them, to watch those workers carry Christmas trees all day. And so I had Senator Smith's staff pick up a Christmas tree and load it into a truck. And he goes, that thing's heavy. I said, now do that all day.
Yeah.
So I think instead of vilifying a workforce, which I'm not saying that we are, but there are productive ways to address this issue and unproductive ways. But as an industry, as a leader in this state, we want to try to find a way to have a legal workforce that is accessible to our nurseries and farms. So I could go on at great length, but I'll stop there.
One of our earlier witnesses, Bob Ba, told us about the importance of making it two-way, and I think described that somewhat in depth. Very important. Vice Chair Lim, folks, if you have to leave for another committee, please feel free.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff, you mentioned that the nursery industry is the third largest industry in the nation.
Nursery industry.
Yeah. Yes, nursery, I'm talking about that. And also 70% going to the east of Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And then mentioned also more than $200 million generated, increased the productivity or sales since the 90s. Do you think this trend will continue on this coming next 10, 20 years? And what is the basic challenges you might have to continue to grow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, I think there's great opportunity for continued growth. I think what we're trying to do and what was going to be key is how do we become more energy efficient as an industry? How do we become more water efficient as an industry? Transportation costs are a huge barrier for us. If we're shipping to New Jersey, it has to be a refrigerated truck. It can't be just you're going on a rail car or whatnot. And that costs a tremendous amount, plus the inheritance tax issues that you heard. All those things in an accumulative fashion will have an effect on what our ability is to grow. So I frankly think that this industry will continue to grow, and Oregon is just very lucky to have the growing conditions that we do, because our quality compared to other states is without peer.
Vice Chair Riley.
Two quick things. One, I think we have to be very careful as we pursue the Measure 37 issue that you folks continue to be able to afford the land that you need to work. And the other issue, as you may or may not know, I don't believe we need to wait for the federal government, as you said, Jeff, to do something about the estate tax. As you may or may not know, Representative Boquist and I last session recommended a $2 million threshold, and that was unfortunately shot down in the House, but hopefully we can do something to help you folks with that.
Sure. Representative Riley, thank you, and I think I'd speak on all of us, our behalf, that we would be happy to enter into a multitude of discussions. We briefly talked about H-2A today, and I can't let that go without a heaping amount of caution. J. Frank Schmidt and Company, one of our larger growers, spent $2 million for 4 employees. By and large, it doesn't work for us. Now, are there opportunities for the legislature to have a conversation with the employment department about how do you make it easier for growers to even go through that process? Absolutely. And we would welcome all of your signatures to do such a thing. But I just don't want to leave you with the impression, we heard that earlier today, and I'm sure I'll have this conversation with our friend who testified earlier today at the Farm Bill Forum tomorrow, that Congressman Blumenauer is doing. But I just wanted to get that on the record very quickly.
Thank you, Jeff. Representative Dahlem.
Now that we've tackled the easy issues of immigration and Measure 37, I am great at developing a list of things to do, and Representative Riley just added to that list. And I heard you say to us that we should have an ag or at least a production exception. And then Representative Riley adds the $2 million. I guess, Don, I'd look to you. Is that threshold for ag of $2 million an approximate figure? Is that close enough?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dahlem, yes, that would be a big help. At the federal level, I believe it's at $2 million now. It goes to 2.5 and it goes to 3.5. If we would mirror that, along with the $2 million, what it needs to be, however, it needs to be indexed so we don't continually have this problem. So if we were to start at the $2 million and index it, I think we'd be fine.
Thank you. So tied to the federal schedule is the second part of that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dolan, the only problem with tying to the federal schedule is in 2011 the whole thing goes away.
Yeah.
So I don't know that we want to tie it.
I thought I found an easy one here, Don.
What I do like about we do need to connect to the extent that we would have the same threshold level exemption along the way until we get to that point where they drop off. So that it makes it easier when you do have an estate, then you aren't having to do calculations for two different systems.
Thank you.
Very quickly, if I may add, Mr. Chair, Representative Dolan, I think the important component here is decide where you want to be and how it's going to help, 80-90% of, I stated today that a lot of our growers are small. But how do you help that 80-90% of agriculture deal with this? I'm reticent to point to a dollar figure because that can be then ensconced in law, and then that has its own problems that Don mentioned. But I think that if we start with a discussion about how do we resolve this issue, and then work our way backward to try to build the road to get there, I think is probably a good way to go.
Good suggestion. Just real quickly here, Terry, you mentioned the importance of our state's economy taking advantage of our natural advantages, agriculture, forestry, and the importance of maintaining an agricultural industry infrastructure. And unfortunately, we see a lot of this eroding. Representative Dahlem and I have both talked about problems that we've run up against. In my instance, a kill floor for hogs in this state. In his instance, a kill floor for beef. We're talking about the infrastructure for our state's second largest industry. And I'm not expecting any two-second answer from you, but have you sat down and put together some of the things that you need as an industry in terms of infrastructure so to give us some ideas of what we ought to be thinking about?
Chair Witt, I'm not sure we really have. I know a number of years ago Farm Bureau was instrumental in putting together a kind of an infrastructure task force to look at that. I'm not sure that actually is still operating, but I think that's a tremendous idea because it goes well beyond. It is almost a chicken and an egg kind of thing. As you start losing farmland, farm income, all of a sudden now there's no need to have a close feed and seed dealership or fertilizer dealership. So now the existing farmers have to travel an extra 50 miles to get their feed and their seed, which adds to the cost of doing their business, which further makes their profitability go down. So it's almost a self-perpetuating kind of negative thing. So I think the whole infrastructure has to be looked at, not just not just land and water, but also the infrastructure to support the inputs as well as market the outputs. So,
gentlemen, thank you so very, very much for an engaging conversation here. If you'll pardon the pun, it has been food for thought, and I do believe a call to action. Thank you for your excellent testimony.
Food for thought.
Ellen, if you would give us a preview for Monday, please.
Monday, February 12th, beginning at 8 a.m., we'll be hearing about the tribal gaming industry and issues in workforce development.
Thank you very much. Committee members, thank you. Witnesses, thank you. With that, we stand adjourned until Monday.
Sure.